Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. I'm Don Marsh. Anybody who spent any time in St. Louis knows Julius Hunter. He is a top-notch journalist and author and dedicated to his hometown community. Put all of these qualities together and you have the wellspring for his latest book. It's fitting it's coming out in this 250th anniversary of the founding of St. Louis because it is history, albeit not history that is often discussed. It's about two St. Louis madams and their role in late 19th century St. Louis. You won't find out much about Priscilla Henry or Babe Connor in any Chamber of Commerce publications, but you will in Julius Hunter's new book titled Priscilla and Babe, From Slavery Shackles to Millionaire Bordello Madams in Victorian St. Louis. Julius, it's a pleasure to see you again.
It's a pleasure to be in the presence of such brilliance, Don.
Well, thank you for that. I didn't quite get that. You want to say
brilliance begins with a B.
Okay. Well, enough of that. Enough of that nonsense. The book is imminently out. Is that correct?
Yes, it is. And I mean, any second now, I can feel it. I feel like perhaps a mother in the delivery room. You know, centimeters. Can we talk about that?
Well, we're talking about bordellos. I suppose we can. Go ahead.
I was going to say that one of the other reasons, and it's not perhaps evident from your intro, that these were two African-American women, mm-hmm. both of them born enslaved. I've been told that we shouldn't just say born as slaves, and the enslaved part has been added by those who want to give them a little dignity. But they were both born enslaved, one of them on a plantation in Alabama, one on a plantation outside Nashville. And they made their way to St. Louis. They got some syndicate backing, each one of them separately. And they set up the most luxurious, the most opulent bordellos in St. Louis. In fact, I guess we could say pimp. Pimp is a very old word. We don't use it a lot. But the agent of Priscilla wanted to call her place a bagnio. For those of us who want to learn a new word, it's a bagnio, he wanted to call it, rather than a bordello or a brothel, but same thing.
What kind of competition did they have in town? Was there a lot of this going on?
Well, nobody would believe it because St. Louis has kept a lot of its history quiet, you know, sort of smoothed over. But at one time, 1870s, there were 5,000 streetwalkers on the city streets of St. Louis, and that is with a population of about 300,000. We fiddled with, by the way, the population numbers in 1870 to try to get ahead of Chicago. So about 85,000 names were added to the St. Louis registry there so we could be ahead of Chicago, but about 300,000 in 1870.
How many bordellos?
The bordello numbers could not be enumerated, Don, mainly because they were not operating just out of houses. There were a lot of them that were operating out of rooms around through the city in the area that was called Chestnut Valley, right around where we are now, by the way, in your studios.
You know, I want to talk more, obviously, about these ladies and about the times, mm-hmm. but you described this book as creative nonfiction. You better explain that for me.
Well, I tell you, there are a lot of people who are scratching their heads about that. How can you have creative nonfiction? Well, I took the definition of one critic, Barbara Lounsbery, who says there are four elements you have to have before you can have creative nonfiction. She says the information has to be documentable subject matter that's chosen from real people, places, and incidents from the real world. That's number one. Number two, you have to have done exhaustive research. And I might say that we qualified for that because I've been working on this book. My friends and family are so tired of hearing about it for at least 6 years now. 6 years of heavy-duty research work from everything from digging around in libraries, cemeteries, churches, and we have seven contemporary newspapers, the Victorian era that we use. So my house has become the residence of those two ladies, Priscilla and Babe. It's Priscilla Henry and Sarah Babe Connor. That was the second point, the exhaustive research. Now, the third point that this critic, Professor Lounsbury, says is that the author has to place that story in a credible setting. I mean, you can't have it done on the planet Xenon or something like that. So we have the setting that is in Alabama for the one lady, Priscilla, and Nashville and St. Louis for Sarah Babe Connor. And then the fourth is that it has to be pure, unadulterated, creative nonfiction, and it must be done in a fine writing style.
Well, there you go.
There you go. I think I made it on all four counts.
You know, I'm looking forward to reading it. As we've indicated, it's imminently out, and no one has really had a chance to look at it. But I have learned something through conversations with you about it.
You and I must write at least every other day to each other.
I think so, to keep the arthritic fingers working. I know you've done exhaustive research, but there still must have been a tremendous amount of frustration in all of this, given the records of the day. I mean, six newspapers is really not sufficient to do a total job.
No, but I think that readers will find some shocking information in this book. In the appendage, I have such things as the invoice for the furnishings that were done in these elegant bordellos. Both of them, by the way, were on South 6th Street, 206, 208, and 210 South 6th Street. I'm going to get that out with on the list. And here's what's incredible about it, Don, is those three addresses on South 6th Street are the exact entrance to the new Busch Stadium, the exact entrance to where – so people have crossed the threshold of these three places.
Right. And two of them belong to one of these ladies.
Two of them belong to Priscilla Henry. She opened one with her backing, I should say, at 206 South 6th Street.
Will you stop saying that?
I know it's driving your engineers crazy back there. But she was able to buy, and you can probably figure out why, she was able to buy the townhouse, three-story townhouse next door to her very easily and very quickly after moving in. The little lady said, yeah, you can have it for whatever you want. And then Babe, as quite a surprise to Priscilla, Priscilla was not very happy about it. Babe moved right next door to her and set up her operation. The city did not allow prostitutes to mix by race under one roof. So Priscilla had a house for black prostitutes, one for white prostitutes, and along comes Babe with mulatto prostitutes. And she chuckled and said, I understand from some sources, well, they now have a choice of vanilla, chocolate, or caramel.
Who was the clientele?
Now, there is when I've talked to groups, we get into trouble. Hmm. Obviously, they had to be men of means who came to these places. And very interestingly, a lot of women that I talked to today are in denial. They would say, oh, no, my George would never... Well, I'm going to tell you, George must have been there a time or two. And it's also, Don, during that period of time, I think there were a lot of wives and girlfriends who were saying to their guys, look, go have a couple of nights out because, I mean, don't bring home any diseases. But the whole matter of child bearing and child delivery was a very terrifying thing for women. I mean, there were a lot of deaths that were involved there. And Queen Victoria, who gave the era its name, said she hated being pregnant because she felt like a dog or a cow, quote-unquote. She also said, babies are ugly. They move too weirdly like frogs, she said. She had nine kids. But she also turned the whole attitude about the women going through child delivery without any kind of anesthesia, and was heard to yell to her anesthesiologist at one point, or not anesthesiologist, her doctor during delivery, bring on the doggone chloroform. And women then all across the world began to think they did not have to go through childbirth and hurt and be in pain.
You know, that hasn't changed a whole heck of a lot since with regard to the discomfort that women face. I think of that famous Bill Cosby skit. Maybe you remember it, where the woman would stand up in the stirrups, give me an epidural. She shrieked at the
right,
time.
And he said, Bill Cosby, I think, said, delivering a child is like pulling your bottom lip up over your head.
That's right. I think that was in the same piece of business. You mentioned the women would say probably, don't come home with the disease.
Right.
Were the ladies, if you will, at that time, were they protected somehow?
Well, that is one of the reasons for wanting to curb prostitution. That was one of the primary reasons, is because of the disease that was involved. And they learned, particularly during the time of the Civil War, that is when venereal disease just exploded. There were women who actually followed the troops around, you know. And I guess it was General Hooker who wanted his men to have the pleasures of women, and that's why prostitutes began to be called hookers. They also noticed when Nashville was trounced and conquered by Union troops in 1862, General Rosecrans noted that half the casualties his men had after that battle were due to venereal diseases. And he came up with the most ridiculous idea I've heard of or read about in preparing this book. He got 111 of the white prostitutes in his town, in Nashville, and put them on a boat and shipped them to Louisville without even asking Louisville if they could come. And these women floated around, unfortunately, a sad story, for 28 days and had to come back again to Nashville.
How did they treat the women, do you know? The women who had the disease.
Well, it was rough treatment, and St. Louis passed what was called the Social Evil Ordinance of 1870. That required houses to get licenses, the madams in particular, and the prostitutes in town. And they were supposed to get a weekly exam, a weekly medical exam. Well, the mayor and the police chief, I think, were lying to the world about how successful that was. They said, well, we've got 600 to 800 women who have registered already within a year. Well, there were 5,000 on the street. Sure. And that really sort of went by the boards after a while to get a woman to go in once a week for a checkup. I tell you an interesting thing with regard to the 6 degrees of separation that this book brings you.
Hold that thought, if you would. I have to take a break, and it's a good part of the story.
Okay, 6 degrees of separation.
Let's try to remember it in our dotage, Julius
Hunter. All right, I'll write it down.
We're talking with Julius Hunter about his new book, which will be available to all of you within a day or two, we're told. The title of the book is Priscilla and Babe, From Slavery Shackles to Millionaire Bordello Madams in Victorian St. Louis, Our Town. We'll be back to continue the discussion in a moment. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Hello again, and welcome back to our conversation with Julius Hunter. We are talking about his seventh book, Priscilla and Babe, From Slavery Shackles to Millionaire Bordello Madams in Victorian St. Louis, and it'll be on the stands in a day or two. Julius, we left before the break talking about 6 degrees of separation. What do you mean?
Well, this book is going to absolutely blow the minds of everybody who picks it up. And in fact, I'm willing to bet anybody that if after 5 or 6 pages of this book, you don't begin saying, I'll be darned, or I didn't know that, or you've got to be kidding, I will eat my hat. Now, I put on speed dial, I put the hat manufacturer downtown on notice that he's going to probably be getting some calls. But listen to some of the names you're going to find in this book. And it's not a real hard push. Francis Scott Key, Alex Haley, Andrew Jackson, James Madison, and Thomas Jefferson, Ignaz Paderewski, Oscar Wilde, Charles Dickens, Madam C.J. Walker, W.C. Handy, Scott Joplin, T.S. Eliot's granddaddy, William Greenleaf Elliott, Joseph Pulitzer, Aunt Jemima, Teddy Roosevelt, Helen Keller, and Madam Kate Clark. Now, on the matter, we were talking about prostitutes getting their weekly checkups. One of the people who was in charge of that project after the Social Evil Ordinance of 1870 was Joseph Pulitzer, Joe Pulitzer, who was in charge of keeping a check on the registered women for their checkups. He quit after a short time. He didn't stay long on that job, can you imagine? But as a member of the police board was charged with trying to get the women to go in for their weekly checkups.
It was just a failure, I guess.
It was
given,
a failure.
Given the overwhelming number of women who were out there. Well, let's get in a little bit more to the 6 degrees of separation. Mm-hmm. I mean, Thomas Jefferson was not exactly a contemporary in 1870s or later.
No, but Priscilla was born in 1829, and Thomas Jefferson and James Madison were both big farmers, as you know. Mm-hmm. And Priscilla's master was the wealthiest man in Alabama. He was the father of thoroughbred horse racing in America. And his friends and buddies were James Madison and Thomas Jefferson, who would send him shoots and seeds and saplings all the time for him to try out on his Alabama plantation. I think it's not unreasonable, with Priscilla having been born in 1829, she might have planted some of the seeds that James Madison or Thomas Jefferson said.
That's, so we should be reminded they were slave owners
absolutely.
In those days. And,
big time.
Yeah. Right. Okay. Now, another one I'd like to clarify. I do know that Charles Dickens, about this time, was making a grand tour of the United States. How do you connect him to the story?
Well, he was making a very, very devout trip to try to find out what St. Louis was doing to handle the problem of prostitution. As St. Louis had 5,000 prostitutes, London had at least 8,000 streetwalkers. These were not the women working inside bordellos or bagnios, as we learned the word today. But he came here to see if there were any fresh ideas. He had set up this college school home for wayward women in London, to the west of London. But I have to tell you, there's a little story in this book about why he was kicked off the board. He paid for it. But it turns out that Charles Dickens, God bless him, had a 15-year-old lover. He said she was an actress. Others said she was more or less, however you want to look at it. And he spent a little bit too much time around the place. He wanted to interview every girl that came into the place, and it was a little something rather.
There was a movie that came out fairly recently about his affair. I've forgotten the name of it, but within the last year or two.
Well, talk about the 6 degrees again. William Bixby, who built the house on Portland Place, mm-hmm. that's the cover of my book, mm-hmm. Built a library addition onto that house on Portland Place, in which he had some of the original Shakespeare folios, but also the love letters of Charles Dickens mm-hmm. in that original library.
Of course, when Dickens would have been here, I might have my ears a little bit off, but I think a fellow by the name of Jack the Ripper was probably fairly busy in London, on the streets of London, involving streetwalkers at about this same time.
Oh, yeah.
Was that a problem here, that kind of thing, crimes against these street women?
There were no crimes against the streetwalkers that were that made the big splashy headlines.
Sure.
But, of course, St. Louis kind of buried over a lot of its problems.
Let's get back to Priscilla and Babe and, mm-hmm. and their establishments. They were rivals. They did not know each other prior to coming to St. Louis. How in the world did it happen that these two women, former slaves, suddenly show up in St. Louis, find the funding that you mentioned before, and suddenly establish these places that were known far beyond St. Louis?
All over the country they were known. And in fact, when there was a poisoning case involving Priscilla, The Los Angeles Times was reporting on the fact that the whole investigation here in town was blown. I like to think they were the darker-skinned Kardashians of their era. I mean, they really didn't do any talent or anything, but they were well-known all around. And their competition turned out not to be such tough competition because, as Babe noticed, they had vanilla, chocolate, and caramel, living right next door.
What about the establishments themselves? I mean, I know from some of the things I've read about your book that they were unique, I guess, in town, certainly.
They were. There was Madam Eliza Haycraft, who was sort of the ruling queen of the bordellos in St. Louis, who died in 1871. And she left a big void, a big vacuum that the backers of Priscilla and Babe said, you know, this might be a time to slip, you know, an African-American woman in here to run places of ill repute, shall we say. And they kind of slipped in right after Eliza Haycraft, a Missourian, by the way, who was from Callaway County, Missouri. She died leaving $30 million in property and in money. So it had to be big business we're talking about, Don.
And Priscilla and Babe were no slouches in the money-making department either.
No, each of them was worth about $1.8 to $2 million each at their heyday.
Didn't I read that one of them had diamonds in their teeth?
Oh, yes, yes. Babe was a marketing genius before anyone that we knew. First of all, she painted her brownstone house on 6th Street white, stark white, so she could call it the castle. She also had diamonds in her teeth. She had an annual membership. I searched all around to find if there were any others like that, but she had an annual membership for which the members got a specially minted coin that allowed them entrance, but everything else was a la carte, shall we say. And she also had a habit of driving around in a... Well, before I get to that, she put women in all the front windows of this townhouse, all three stories, writhing and dancing and that sort of thing. People say, oh, she got the idea from Amsterdam. No, I had my Amsterdam agent check, and Amsterdam did not start doing the girl in the window thing until 1924, in which they were allowed to peek through the curtains. But she had full-bodied ladies dancing in the windows.
That was picked up not only in Amsterdam, but in Hamburg, Germany, as I recall, too,
having
spent a little time in terms...
Wait a minute. How do you want to get out of it? You spent a
little time in Germany.
In Germany.
I'll only take it that far.
All right.
Was there any interaction at all between these ladies? I mean, they were neighbors. They were in the same business. They did not know each other in their previous lives.
No.
What kind of interaction?
There was, from what I found, there was live and let live kind of interaction between them. They were two different kind of women. Priscilla, living on that plantation for almost 30 years of her life before she was freed, and the widow, mistress of the plantation, waited a long time before telling her slaves that they were free. So she was about 32 years old when she came to St. Louis. Babe was about 25 years younger, and she was wild and crazy. She was the first woman admitted to the Jockey Club here in St. Louis. She smoked cigars. She gambled away thousands of dollars on the ponies, and she took her staff to Saratoga, New York on a couple of occasions just for a week of R&R and fun and gambling.
There's a movie in this, Julius. There's a movie in this. I have to take
Queen
another
break. Queen Latifah and Halle Berry, where are you?
All right. We'll look for that. Julius Hunter, my guest, Priscilla and Babe, From Slavery Shackles to Millionaire Bordello Madams in Victoria, St. Louis, is the book. It'll be out in a day or two and readily available, I'm sure. We have to take another break. We'll do that now and come back with Julius. Stay with us. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Now back to our conversation with Julius Hunter. We're talking about his brand-new book, Priscilla and Babe, From Slavery Shackles to Millionaire Bordello Madams in Victorian St. Louis. You know, I wasn't kidding, Julius, before going to the break. This has all the elements of a pretty good movie, I think.
I really think so. And if I can tie up those two, not tie them up, let's say it another way, get Queen Latifah and Halle Berry and Kevin Spacey, I will need for the bad guy in the movie. And I should say, Don, as a caution here, this is not a sleazy, salacious book with steamy sex scenes in it. And if someone is expecting this to be a sequel to what I call 50 Grades of Shay, it's what I said. Someone always says, don't you mean 50 Grades? Yeah. I said, well, you must have read this. I don't know. Is that what it's called? You know?
Your approach to it was as a history of a part of the city history at a particular time.
Right, and it was a study, and I must say that there are some people who expected that this was going to be thrown into the trash heap of Black History Day, week, month, or something, but I wanted it to get into St. Louis's 250th anniversary, because this is a part of the city. This is, you know, the part of the city that nobody talked about, but somebody was supporting those two women to make them millionaires. Now, who were they, Don?
Who were they? the gentlemen of the day.
They were the gentlemen of the day. Yeah.
What was the most I started to ask this question before and we got sidetracked. The frustrating, most frustrating, pardon me, what is it you really wanted to know about these two ladies in that time that you were unable to find out?
Well, the sad thing is that there are no portraits of them. Photography had not taken full bloom yet. And so I sat down with very talented artist Todd Bauman one time around my dining room table and took all the newspaper descriptions of these two women, and we reconstructed what they would have looked like. They were both big-boned women. We learned that Priscilla wore very, very Victorian-style dresses, dark and that kind of thing. Babe wore gowns made in Paris, and she had the diamonds in the teeth for a while until they fell out, and she wore jewelry on every part of her body that was showing that we knew. And so we were able to draw some pictures that Todd did, which will be at the County Library, the Schlafly Library, St. Louis University, when I'm running around to those places. He did some really great, I think, some great constructions of what those women would look like.
By the way, I'll point out to our listeners that we have a list on our website of some of the places you'll be appearing in the next week or two or three.
Well, until December, actually.
Good. Well, that is certainly good.
I will even drop by people's house to tell them about it.
were you able to find out why it was that when they were emancipated that they decided to go into this line of work?
Well, that is one of the key points of the story, how they happened to fall into this. Neither one of them started out to become a madam. They sort of fell into it. And with Priscilla in particular, there was a real tragedy and a catastrophe that threw her into this business that she ended up in. And also we found through a lot of the women that are in this book, that they came to St. Louis because they heard that washerwomen in St. Louis made more money than in any place in the country.
What got you into this? What did you hear or see that made you decide to research this?
Well, there was a dear lady, Eleanor Martineau Coyle, who was teaching a course in continuing education at University City Public Library, at least 40 years ago, Don, at least 40 years ago. And she mentioned in two sentences about a Black woman who had become a millionaire bordello madam, and her boyfriend agent had killed himself when he was found to be stealing from her. That's all she told us. And for some reason, that remained in the back of my mind for 40 years at least, and until we got the resources through the County Library and the Julius K. Hunter and Friends African American Research Collection at the County Library. Mm-hmm. Commercial. And we have all these newspapers. And I didn't even have a name for Priscilla until we started. And it's just amazing. And I guarantee you, you will not find her name in any literature anywhere. But you'll know more about her after reading this book than you could ever, ever want to believe.
Let me let our listeners know, too, that we can take some phone calls. We're going to be with Julius for another 10 minutes or so. If you'd like to get into the conversation, give us a call at 382-8255. That's 382-TALK. You can send us an email at talk@stlpublicradio.org or, of course, a tweet at STL on air. Julius, let's deviate from the book for a moment.
Another word than deviate, though,
Don. I didn't say deviate. I said deviate. Okay. We'll get back to that in a moment, but I'd like to get on to some other things with you because you've been around for a while, a respected newsman here. Just like to get your take on what you've seen going on in your town over the last 6-8 weeks. I'm referring, of course, to Ferguson.
Yes, I must say that I'm saddened every day of my life since that's happened. The whole incidence of an unarmed person being shot to death and shot so many times, and the whole racial aspects of that. And I must say that I've been quiet on it because I really think there are too many people who have nothing to do with Ferguson who are throwing their 2 cents worth, their $2 worth into it. And first of all, I hate to see all of the professional carpetbaggers roll into town who are peddling their patent medicine on this case. And when a TV guy says, I'm headed to Ferguson now to look into it. Well, you know, that has been going on in Ferguson for about 45 years. So I would rather that TV person say, I'm going to spend the next 45 days studying this before I go into it to sell my patent medicine. And there are some of these guys who look like their job is to console the grieving mother. They're in every picture of that. Or they're in the middle of the front row of every parade and rally. Seems like that is their role. And I also, unfortunately, Don, I know you and I had to start out at some point as Cub reporters, but it's sad that so many Cub reporters with no background at all, Ferguson started happening, as I said, 45 years ago before the parents of some of these young reporters were born. And they're kind of thrown into a situation where they have to wax eloquent on a very complicated situation. I feel sorry for them and for the stations that are involved.
Yeah. You're a former member of the police board and in the city of St. Louis. And the police in this particular case have taken a lot of lumps. What's your perspective on that?
Well, I think in many cases they deserve to take lumps. I think the lumps they've been given by everybody from Putin to Gandhi's grandson. I mean, think about that range. I think there are some police, 99% of the police officers that I've come in contact with are great, great people. There are some police officers, though, you run across who could not get onto this police department, could not get onto that police department or whatever, and they end up sort of lumped together in police departments that, you know, certainly they should not be in a tank driving through the street to quell some riot. And I think that whole matter has to be looked into where you give heavy warfare material to policemen to put down riots and all. They've noticed that when they've backed away from some of their militant looks, it's gotten a little quieter.
Well, what about the issue of image? You're a native St. Louisan. I've been here for 45 years. This is our community, and it's been sullied, I think, almost around the world, probably around the world. Thoughts on that?
Well, I cannot believe the sources that I hear talking about it, as I said, from Vladimir Putin to Jon Stewart to Stephen Colbert to all of the comedians that are making fun of it, Saturday Night Live, everything. It bothers me because they don't know the situation. And I think there is a time when this has to be solved by the good people of Ferguson, the black Fergusonians and the white Fergusonians. They need some mediation and some guidance, but they are the ones that have to decide what happens henceforth. And I think this is a terrible time for Attorney General Eric Holder to be leaving. I mean, he got into the picture, and I know he wants to get out of the picture and retire, but he should not, in my opinion, leave at this time. I think he should set up an office in Ferguson and say, I'm going to spend the next 6 months living there as Attorney General.
Well, the Justice Department has been having these meetings, which has maintained kind of a presence, I guess, throughout all of this. The complaints that the young people in particular have, and the older people too, I should not exclude anybody, who have been demonstrating is the fact that that they've been hassled throughout their lives, driving while black, you know, the warrants and the fines and all the rest of it. This is not something that is unknown to you growing
Absolutely
up.
Absolutely not. I was born two blocks from here, 722 A North Vandeventer, upstairs over a barber shop, and I'm looking for the plaque to
now,
be put up
someday. Now a National Historic Site. Yes, I know. I get it.
Right. But when my buddies, Jim Trimble and Victor Kirkpatrick and Arthur Cannell and I went out when we were high school kids, and we were in Jim Trimble's 57 Ford Fairlane, we could count on every single Friday night, every single Saturday night, we would be made to get out of our cars at least once and hug a building and get patted down. That was the way it was. And I don't think people would believe in St. Louis. I remember the time here in St. Louis when a black police officer could not arrest a white person unless a white cop were present. I mean, that seems bizarre, doesn't it?
Yeah, I've heard about that. That's not so awfully long ago either.
Yeah, no, well, I know that whole thing about driving while black was really a problem. I don't think we find that in the city of St. Louis where I live.
Only 2 minutes left. We finally have a call from Jerry here that I was late in asking people to call in. Jerry, we'll take a call, but it has to be really, really quick. Go ahead.
Well, good morning. I just want to say it's always good to hear Julius Hunter. I read a lot of history, and I don't think the market is the invisible force in history as much as sex is, and all the way to the present day, where I don't think President Obama would have had as easy a time getting his Senate seat if his Republican opponent had not had to step down due to a sex scandal. So thank you for bringing this new to us history to light. Thank you.
Thank you, Jerry.
Well, as I said, this book is about sex, but there's not a lot of sex in it. There's really no real scandal in it. It's more of a look at the personalities of those persons who were responsible for the underpinning of the prostitution business in St. Louis during the Victorian era. That's the point.
The Victorian era that we all have heard and read so much about was not quite as prudish either here or in London as a lot of people thought.
Nor anywhere else.
Okay. Our time is just about up. Julius, you're going to be meeting and greeting people over the next little while.
County Library next, and that's on the 29th, Wednesday the 29th, St. Louis County Library, 7 o'clock. And then the Schlafly Library on the 5th. After that,
okay.
7 o'clock.
As I have indicated, we'll have all of that information on our website. And I'll remind the audience once again that the title of the book, and I have to read it because like all books these days, there's a title and there's a long subtitle. It is Priscilla and Babe, From Slavery Shackles to Millionaire Bordello Madams in Victorian St. Louis. The book is just coming out, even as we speak. Congratulations to you on book number 7, and good luck with it, Julius. It's great to see you again.
Thank you, Don, and it's great to be with you as always, and let's get together for some food again soon.
We'll do that within the next week or so.
Okay.
Thank you. St. Louis on the Air has spent a lot of time in recent weeks on the Ferguson story we just were talking about. It's been an important story, and during this pledge drive week, producers Mary Edwards, Alex Hoyer, and I sat down to reflect on that story and how we handled it.
In my 4 decades as public radio, I don't think there's been anything that I've been involved with that affected me more profoundly than the community meeting that we had in Ferguson. I thought that I, as a lifelong St. Louisan and being a journalist, that I had some idea about what it was like to be black in this area. And by the time that was over, my head was just spinning for days, and I realized that what I know and have experienced is just the tip of the iceberg.
Right. NPR's Michelle Martin came into town with some of her producers, and It was probably one of the events that I'm most proud of in my career, just because it was such raw emotion at the time, and it was a conversation that had to happen. And it's not a conversation that we had here in our studio, but we went out to the community, and that's exactly where we needed to be.
When we were in the midst of that and seeing the raw emotion and the passion of the people that came that night, it gave me a new appreciation and understanding for what they go through. As a radio person, you never want to lose control of your microphone, and my position that night was manning the audience microphone, and a couple of times someone grabbed it, and just in the emotion of it, but then I realized that was not a bad thing, that they were just pouring their hearts out to the people on the panel and the people present.
I think you are completely right, Mary, in that that's what needed to happen, but it was powerful. I didn't know what to think at the time, and to a certain extent, we just let it play out.
What you've just said is exactly what the protesters want, and that is for white people to understand what it's like to be black.
There are two instances in particular. One is a young man who, holding the microphone, actually pulled his shirt up to show us the wound from the rubber bullet.
Why didn't this incident have to occur for all this to happen? When I had to get shot in the back. So that means I'm going this way and they aiming at me.
Who shot you?
The people you put out there.
Let me see.
A Ferguson cop shot you.
Were you really?
Police, man. We was marching.
When?
Y'all said it was a curfew at 8. Y'all said it was a curfew at 12. At 12. We was out there at 8. On the front line, it was keys.
And what did they shoot you with?
What they shot me with? How do I know when they throwing grenades?
But again, so that's...
It's right there. Look at that. I got a mark on me. How many times do I got to... How many times do I have to deal with this?
Again,
I don't know what it is, because they shot behind us where they're trying to push us to.
And this happened during
the demonstration.
Wait, let me ask you this.
Let me explain again.
How can you explain this?
The tactical teams, I'm glad to answer for anything that any of our officers have done.
And that particular photo was the one that I think everybody pointed to as what the essence of that event was about.
That is the iconic photo from that forum. But I don't even think the photo was necessary. I think people could hear in the audio what was happening.
Which was really giving people a chance to get together and raise their voices once again in a coherent manner with a wonderful host running the show.
And I remember another white person got up there, and basically the only thing he said was, "I want my time to be had by one of these young black men." And I thought that was kind of powerful, that in the midst of all this, that there was this guy who said, "I want my time that you've given to me to go to somebody else."
If nothing else, the Ferguson incident has pointed out that there is a sharp disparity between the poor black people of that community and the white people. They get arrested more, they get fined more, and they just they're hassled more by police. And most white people, I think, didn't understand that before this message was given loud and clear by these protesters. Now the journey of 1,000 miles begins with that single step. And we are back live now on St. Louis on the Air. I'm Don Marsh, and you were just listening to a sit-down that producers Mary Edwards and Alex Hoyer and I had, talking about the role that we played in covering the Ferguson story during these last weeks. An important story it is, and during this Pledge Week, we thought we'd just remind you that we're at work all the time on trying to pull all this information together that is so important for all of us to have. Well, let's look to tomorrow. Join Steve Potter tomorrow for Cityscape, and he'll talk with jazz pianist and vocalist John Pizzarelli about his Jazz St. Louis performances, and with pediatrician and vocalist Ken Haller about his cabaret show called I Remember Mama. He'll also take a look at an exhibition at the Philip Sline Gallery highlighting the influences of an African-American tradition called a cull, that is, from various collections, private collections in the St. Louis area. Archive versions of past St. Louis On the Air programs available for download or podcast at stlpublicradio.org. This program is produced by Mary Edwards, Alex Hoyer, and with production assistance from Eric Smith, Erica Smith, Aaron Dorr, Emma Brown, and Spencer Reed. Executive producers Robert Peterson. Thank you so much for listening. I'm Don Marsh.